This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hello, my name is John Zinser, and this is the New York Times NewsHour for Friday, the 10th of May, 2024. Our first article. Breach grows between Biden and Israelis leaders over Rafah invasion. Defiant Israelis have vowed to do, quote, whatever is necessary, end quote, in the Gaza Strip, despite the American president's threat to withhold weapons. This article is by Adam Raskon, Julian E. Barnes, and Michael Levinson. Israeli leaders declared on Thursday that they would not be deterred by President Biden's threat to withhold more arms shipments if the military launched a major assault on densely populated areas of Rafah in southern Gaza. Defiant and at times disdainful of the Biden administration's stance, their comments made clear the widening rift between Israel and the United States over the war and the prospect of a full-scale invasion of Rafah, where about 1 million Palestinians are sheltering. And they came as high-level negotiations aimed at reaching a ceasefire and hostage deal were derailed, at least for the moment, amid anger by some of the participants over a military incursion into Rafah by Israeli forces earlier this week. After that incursion, Mr. Biden said the United States, Israel's closest ally, would not ship more weapons that could be fired into crowded sections of Rafah. On Thursday, an Israeli military spokesman said his nation had enough munitions on hand to proceed with its plans. Other Israeli leaders said the military would press ahead with its campaign to destroy Hamas, which led the October 7 attacks on Israel. Quote, I turned to Israel's enemies, as well as to our best of friends, and say, the state of Israel cannot be subdued, end quote. Israel's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, said at a memorial ceremony. He said that the country would do, quote, whatever is necessary, end quote, to defend its citizens and, quote, to stand up to those who attempt to destroy us, end quote. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, while not responding directly to Mr. Biden, also struck a defiant tone. Quote, if we need to stand alone, we will stand alone, end quote, he said. Itamar Ben-Gvir, Israel's far-right national security minister, was openly scornful of the American president. Quote, Hamas, heart emoji, Biden, end quote, he wrote on social media, drawing what appeared to be a rebuke from Israel's president, Isaac Herzog. Even when allies disagree, Mr. Herzog said, quote, there is a way to clarify the disputes, end quote. On Tuesday, American officials disclosed that Mr. Biden had withheld 1,800 and 2,000 pound bombs and 1,700 and 500 pound bombs out of concerns that they could be dropped on Rafah. The administration was reviewing whether to hold back future transfers, including kits that convert so-called dumb bombs into precision-guided munitions, the officials said. American-made weapons, including heavy bombs, have been essential to Israel's war effort. But as the death toll in Gaza rises, Mr. Biden has been under mounting domestic pressure to rein in Israeli offensive. In his comments on Wednesday, during an interview with CNN, He acknowledged that U.S. bombs had killed civilians in Gaza. The Biden administration's concerns have only grown since Israeli tanks and troops entered eastern Rafah on Monday night, taking over the main border crossing between Gaza and Egypt. Israeli forces have stopped short of entering built-up parts of the city, but Mr. Netanyahu and others have signaled that such an operation is necessary to eliminate Hamas battalions there. John F. Kirby, the White House national security spokesman, reiterated on Thursday that while Mr. Biden still supports Israel's goal of defeating Hamas, quote, smashing into Rafah, in his view, will not advance that objective, end quote. Nadav Eyal, a prominent columnist for Yedoth Abaranath, a centrist Israeli newspaper, wrote on social media that Mr. Biden's shift on weapons for Israel was, quote, the most serious clash between an American administration and the government of Israel since the first Lebanon War, end quote. During that conflict, which began in 1982, the Reagan administration suspended the delivery of cluster-type artillery ammunition and other weapons to Israel. Quote, we've reached a boiling point, end quote, Mr. Eyal said in an interview. Quote, issues that have been negotiated behind closed doors have now been brought into the public view in a very ugly way, end quote. Some observers had seen signs this week that Hamas and Israel were edging closer to a deal that would result in a ceasefire and the exchange of hostages being held in Gaza in return for Palestinian prisoners detained in Israel. But on Thursday, high-level talks in Cairo were put on hold, according to officials briefed on the negotiations and Egyptian state media. One official said anger had flared among participants over Israel's seizure of the Rafah border crossing. While mid-level Egyptian, Qatari, and American officials remained in Cairo, the Hamas and Israeli delegations both left on Thursday. Hamas and Israeli officials said, William J. Burns, the CIA director and top American negotiator, also left Cairo, according to multiple officials. The officials all spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss diplomatic negotiations. Mr. Burns had met with Mr. Netanyahu on Wednesday in an effort to persuade Israel to continue negotiating over a ceasefire proposal recently revised by Hamas. One official said the negotiators did not believe that Hamas or Israel were leaving the negotiations permanently, and a senior Egyptian official told state-owned television that mediation efforts were still underway to bridge the differences between Israel and Hamas. Hamas is seeking an end to the war and the complete withdrawal of Israeli troops, while Israel is offering a temporary ceasefire. Mr. Netanyahu has said that Israel will not stop fighting until Hamas is eliminated and all the hostages are freed. Israel's incursion into Rafah this week has displaced about 80,000 people there, most of whom are now sheltering in the southern city of Khan Yunis, or along the Mediterranean coast in Deir el-Baha, both areas that lack basic services, Farhan Haq, a United Nations spokesman, said on Thursday. The Israeli military had told about 110,000 civilians to evacuate parts of Rafah, which has become a refuge for hundreds of thousands of displaced Palestinians, many of them living in tents without adequate food, water, and sanitation. Riyad al-Masari, a sign language interpreter, said on Thursday that he and his extended family had left Rafah even though he had already moved 5 times since the war began. The prospect of a 6th move was, quote, torture beyond torture, end quote, he said. But, he said, nearby fighting gave him little choice. Quote, we are almost in the middle of danger, end quote, Mr. al-Masari said. Mr. Haq said the goods and fuel had not entered through the Rafah crossing in recent days, and that hospitals may have to shut down their generators in a few days. He said that the World Food Program had reported that its main warehouse in Gaza was inaccessible because of fighting, and that only one bakery in Gaza was still operating. Jens Larke, a spokesman for the UN Humanitarian Office in Geneva, described Rafah as a, quote, highly active war zone, end quote, and said it presented, quote, serious challenges, end quote, for aid distribution in southern Gaza and farther north in the territory. Quote, we reiterate that the party's obligation to facilitate aid does not end at the border or in a drop-off zone, end quote, he said. Quote, aid must safely reach those who need it, end quote. The second article today, how poor tracking of bird flu leaves dairy workers at risk. Farm workers have been exposed to milk infected with the bird flu virus, but there has been virtually no testing on farms, and health officials know little about who may be infected. This article is by Apoorva Mandavili, Linda Kui, and Emily Anthes. Even as it has become increasingly clear that the bird flu outbreak on the nation's dairy farms began months earlier and is probably much more widespread than previously thought, federal authorities have emphasized that the virus poses little risk to humans. Yet, there is a group of people who are at a high risk for infection, the estimated 100,000 men and women who work on those farms. There has been no widespread testing to see how many may be infected. None have been vaccinated against bird flu. That leaves the workers and their families vulnerable to a very poorly tracked pathogen, and it poses broader public health risks. If the virus were to find its way into the wider population, experts say, dairy workers would be a likely route. Quote, we have no idea if this virus is going to evolve to become a pandemic strain, but we know today that farm workers are being exposed, and we have good reason to think that they are getting sick, end quote, said Jennifer Nuzzo, director of the Pandemic Center at Brown University School of Public Health. A majority of dairy farm workers are Spanish-speaking immigrants, often undocumented, who may not have paid sick leave or be protected by occupational safety laws. They may lack access to medical providers, and their employers can be intolerant of absences. Quote, this sector of workers is not only at the very, very highest risk because they're having that direct, intimate contact with discharge, raw milk, with infected animals, but they also at the very, very highest level of risk in terms of having no social safety net, end quote, said Elizabeth Stratter, an organizer with United Farm Workers. Interviews with more than 3 dozen federal and state officials, public health experts, farmers, and workers' organizations show how little is known about what's occurring on farms, how many workers may be affected, how the virus is evolving, and how it's spreading among cows. So far, the virus, called H5N1, has been detected in cattle herds in 9 states, while veterinarians have said there are unconfirmed reports of farm workers with flu-like symptoms. Only 30 have been tested as of Wednesday. Barring extraordinary circumstances, state and federal health officials do not have the authority to demand access to farms. Instead, the Food and Drug Administration and the Department of Agriculture are testing milk and ground beef on grocery shelves for the virus. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is waiting for infected people to show up at clinics. Quote, "Do you want to find out about a virus when it's spreading among people so much that they are coming into emergency rooms in hordes? Or do you want to catch it on the farms so you can treat the people and slow the spread?" End quote, said Rick Bright, the chief executive of Bright Global Health, which focuses on responses to public health emergencies. "A tangled regulatory system complicates the situation," said Dr. Jay Varma, who served in the CDC's Foodborne Diseases branch and oversaw food safety as a deputy commissioner at New York City's health department. The Agriculture Department regulates large commercial farms and can mandate testing of animals, although it has not done so. But not of farm workers. The department, quote, "doesn't ever want to be in a position where it has to declare that food supply from the U.S. is unsafe because some of those food products may be exported to other countries, and that can have a huge economic impact," end quote, Dr. Varma said. The CDC has authority over ports of entry into the United States, but domestically, the agency needs state approval to do much of its work. The FDA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration, the Environmental Protection Agency, and Citizenship and Immigration Services all have roles to play, but each has its bureaucratic layers and institutional culture. This patchwork can be an impediment during a disease outbreak, some experts said. In 2009, the response to a cluster of bacterial infections in a salami product was delayed because the Department of Agriculture regulated the meat. The FDA was responsible for the cracked black pepper that coated it, and the CDC was in charge of investigating the people who became ill. Dr. Nirav Shah, principal deputy director of the CDC, dismissed the notion that bureaucracy was an obstacle as, quote, "overly simplistic," end quote, and said the agencies responding to the outbreak talk numerous times a day to coordinate their activities and to work with state partners. Quote, "This stuff is hard," end quote, he said. But, quote, "we're working together on this because we have common goals," end quote. Wary of scrutiny, very few farms have granted entry to health officials. Dairies found to have infected herds could see as much as a 20% dip in income. Farmers already face stagnant milk prices and high feed and transportation costs. Because of the relatively small number of cases, 36 affected herds out of some 26,000 nationwide, and one infected farm worker, some farmers see the bird flu as a distant threat. Even those who support public health efforts are hesitant to let federal officials on their properties. Jason Schmidt, owns Grazing Plains Farm in Whitewater, Kansas. Quote, an itty-bitty little, end quote, farm, as he refers to it, with 70 dairy cows he raises himself. Mr. Schmidt said he supported the government's public health role, but would not want officials traipsing around his farm. Quote, if he were to see a sick cow, I sure hope I'd report it, end quote, he said. But there's that little devil on my shoulder saying, quote, just keep quiet and divert that milk from those sick cows and put that down the drain and don't say anything, end quote. Mitch Bruning, who owns Mystic Valley Dairy in Sauk City, Wisconsin, said that if his veterinarian determined it was, quote, prudent, end quote, he would test a cow with bird flu symptoms. But, quote, I really don't want the CDC coming to my farm, end quote. So far, the outbreak has affected not small farms, but the giant dairies that increasingly dominate the industry and often rely on migrant workers. The owners of such farms, quote, don't care about our health, they just care that we do our jobs, end quote, said Luis Jimenez, who works on a dairy in upstate New York and founded a group supporting undocumented immigrant farm workers. Quote, their cow's health is more important to them than their workers, end quote, he added. Farms are often geographically remote, and the workers, who sometimes live on site, may not have transportation to reach medical care. And to many, the kinds of symptoms ascribed to bird flu infection may not seem particularly urgent. Quote, we're talking about an eye infection or a cough, and these are people who have backaches and arm aches and broken this and that, said Monica Schock Spana, a medical anthropologist at the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Security. Even without access to farms, health officials could support migrant workers in other settings, advocates noted. Quote, they go to church, they go to stores, they go to restaurants, and there are other ways to reach them, end quote, said Amy Liebman, a program officer at the Migrant Clinicians Network. To make testing more attractive, community centers could offer other health care services, legal assistance, and food, and educate workers on ways they can protect themselves and their families, Ms. Liebman said. Dr. Shah said the CDC was working with veterinarians and organizations like the Migrant Clinicians Network to reach farm workers. Quote, we, too, would like to offer testing to more workers, end quote, he said. On Monday, Dr. Shah asked that state health officials provide goggles, face shields, and gloves to farm workers and collaborate with trusted community organizations to educate them on the importance of the gear in preventing infection. Despite the risks to their health, farm workers are not required to wear protective equipment. Quote, it's not a mandate. No one is being forced to do anything here, end quote, Dr. Shah said. But the nature of farm work and the settings in which it is done, milk parlors that quickly render masks wet and useless, for example, can make wearing protective equipment challenging. A few states have taken steps to contain the outbreak, with limited success. Texas offered to provide protective gear to dairies, but only four came forward, according to a spokesman for the state's health department. Idaho has also offered protective equipment since the outbreak's onset, but no farms have taken up the offer. Idaho health officials have not asked to go onto farms, quote, for privacy and biosecurity reasons, end quote, Dr. Christine Hahn, the state epidemiologist, said in an email, although they helped to test one farm worker for the infection. Michigan is prohibiting exhibition of dairy cows and poultry until the outbreak has subsided. The state does not require testing of cows or farm workers. The current situation has shown that dairy farms may seed new outbreaks that quickly spread, as has long been the case on poultry and pig farms, several experts said. Quote, if you had to hide a novel virus emergence in the United States, one of the best places to hide it would be in animal workers in rural America, end quote, said Dr. Gregory Gray, an infectious disease epidemiologist at the University of Texas Medical Branch. Surveillance of those workers is, quote, not nearly as strong as we might see for other population groups, end quote, he said. To build surveillance networks that include farm workers and their families, federal, state, and local agencies will have to first establish trust, said Dr. Andrew Bowman, a veterinary epidemiologist at Ohio State University. Quote, if you look at the influenza surveillance we've done in swine, that didn't happen overnight, end quote, Dr. Bowman said. Quote, that took a decade to build, end quote. While surveillance is important, some experts cautioned against testing farm workers without first catering to their needs. Quote, if we prepare to collect information that's only going to benefit others and not necessarily directly protect them, I just think that's a very hard thing to do ethically, end quote, Dr. Nuzzo said. Our third article today, Israel's shutdown of Al Jazeera highlights long-running tensions. The network will keep covering the war in Gaza, but it will be harder for Israelis to watch. Israel calls the network a security threat, while Al Jazeera says Israel wants to conceal its brutality. This article is by Vivian Yi, Emma Bubola, and Liam Stack. When Israel ordered Al Jazeera on Sunday to shut down operations there, the network had a reporter covering a government meeting in West Jerusalem, another in an East Jerusalem hotel room, a third in northern Israel to cover clashes on the border with Lebanon, and a fourth in Tel Aviv. But the cameras stopped rolling when Walid al-Umari, the network's bureau chief in Ramallah in the West Bank, ordered all of them to go home. Israeli authorities descended on a room used by Al Jazeera in the Ambassador Hotel in East Jerusalem, confiscating broadcast equipment. Israeli television and internet providers cut off its channels and blocked its websites, though people were still able to find it online. Al Jazeera, the influential Arab news network, says it will continue reporting and broadcasting from the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, but its departure from Israel marks a new low in its long-strained history with a country that much of Al Jazeera's audience in the Arab world and beyond sees as an aggressor and an occupier. The shutdown order, which lasts 45 days and can be renewed, was a break long in the making. Mr. al-Omari said that soon after the Israeli-Hamas war began in October, the network stopped using an office in West Jerusalem, saying that far-right Israelis had used intimidation tactics against the staff there. The network has played a major role in amplifying stories of the killing and suffering of Palestinians in Gaza, heightening worldwide outrage at Israel's conduct. Many defendants of Al Jazeera argue that its work is so strong that Israel wants to intimidate and censor it. But its focus on bloodshed in Gaza has also generated controversy, with some Arab analysts saying it cheerleads for what it portrays as legitimate armed resistance to Israel and presents commentary from Hamas officials and fighters with little critical pushback. The network is backed by the government of Qatar, which allows Hamas political leaders to live and operate in its country. That makes it a compelling target for critics in Israel and beyond who say it is, at best, presenting a one-sided view of the war. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu accused Al Jazeera of inciting violence against Israel and harming Israel's security. Quote, "We knew it was a question of time," end quote, Mr. Al-Omari said of the shutdown in an interview on Tuesday. Israel's government, he said, had long pursued what he called, quote, "a war against Al Jazeera," end quote. Emotionally charged reporting. Since the October 7th Hamas-led attack on Israel and the devastating Israeli military campaign in Gaza that followed, Al Jazeera has relied on its network of journalists in the territory, the most robust of any news outlet, to produce a steady stream of harrowing and emotionally charged reporting. Its broadcasts about Gaza's spiraling hunger crisis fill the screens in many Arab households. Its videos of agonized parents clutching their dead children and bodies being pulled from the rubble flood social media. With other foreign news media blocked by Israel and Egypt from gaining access to Gaza, no outlet with Al Jazeera's global audience can match the breadth of coverage there. Al Jazeera has 7 correspondents stretching from north to southern Gaza, according to its managing editor, Mohamed Moad, along with a large team of camera people, producers, and others. He said in an interview that Israel was, quote, "trying to delegitimize our coverage because we are the only organization covering it from the inside," end quote. Quote, "they want to conceal what's happening in Gaza," end quote, he added. Shuruk Assad, spokeswoman for the Palestinians Journalists Syndicate, said that without Al Jazeera's journalists in Gaza, quote, "we couldn't have known anything, and they have paid for this with their lives," end quote. She cited that 2 Al Jazeera journalists killed there, among at least 92 Palestinian journalists killed since the war began. Unfortunately, our badges, vests, and helmets in Gaza did not provide any protection for us, end quote. Hisham Zakut, an Al Jazeera correspondent in Gaza, wrote in a WhatsApp message. Israeli authorities did not specify their reasoning for barring Al Jazeera, except to say that it harmed Israel's security. But given that the network can continue broadcasting from Gaza, and that its mainly Arab audience can still view the channel using virtual private networks or YouTube, many Israeli commentators called the move symbolic at most. The Association for Civil Rights in Israel, which appealed the order with Israel's High Court, said its limited practical effect, quote, "suggests that it was made to shut down critical voices and to mark Arab media and its viewers as a fifth column," end quote. Condemnation by rights activists. Experts who track the network say its mix of searing footage from Gaza and on-air commentary echoing many of Hamas's claims boosts support for the group's actions, not just sympathy for Palestinians. That applies especially to its Arabic language channel. It also has channels in English and other languages. Quote, "the fact that it just gives the primary platform to Hamas, Hamas officials, Hamas spokesmen, etc., the fact that it cuts off any voices that are critical of Hamas, it has basically made it such that on Al Jazeera, Hamas is really the spokesman for the Palestinian people," end quote, said Gahith Al Omari, a Palestinian affairs analyst for the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, and a former advisor to Mahmoud Abbas, the Palestinian Authority president. Al Jazeera rejects accusations that it is a mouthpiece for Hamas, saying in a statement that Israel's ban is a, quote, criminal act, end quote, that violates, quote, the basic right to access of information, end quote. The closure of Al Jazeera's operations has added fuel to the allegations, denied by Israel, that Israel is attempting to hide the devastation in Gaza. Quote, Israel is trying to control the narrative, and it's trying to deprive even the Israeli audience from seeing the atrocities in Gaza, end quote, said Jamil Dakwar, a law professor at New York University and a founding attorney of Adala, the Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. Sunday's decision drew condemnation from rights advocates. A spokesman for the U.S. State Department, Matthew Miller, said on Monday, quote, we think Al Jazeera ought to be able to operate in Israel as they operate in other countries. Analysts who follow Al Jazeera's coverage say the network differentiates itself from other Arabic language channels by broadcasting Israeli officials' news conferences and inviting Israeli analysts and officials to appear on the air. But in general, Al Jazeera tends to embrace the views held by many Arabs, broadcasting analysis, quote, that glorifies the act of resistance, end quote, against what it portrays as, quote, aggression by the occupation settler army, end quote. That is, Israel, said Mohammed Khalil, a media studies professor at Cairo University. He added that Al Jazeera's military analysts often exaggerated Palestinian battlefield successes and downplayed Israeli gains. Mr. Al Omari of the Washington Institute said the network had also elided the worst of the October 7th attacks on Israel, helping to give rise to persistent denials among some Arabs of some of the bloodiest acts that the Palestinian attackers had committed there. Early in the war, Al Jazeera posted to social media a video released by Hamas that purported to show its assailants taking care of children at an Israeli kibbutz they had attacked on October 7th, leaving out the context. They had killed the children's mother. It attracted 1.4 million viewers on Facebook. Asked about the video, Mr. Mowad said that the network had also aired live footage of an Israeli military spokesman saying that Hamas attackers had taken women and children from the kibbutz. Quote, we air and broadcast footage from both sides without editing to ensure our viewers are up to date with the developments and have heard both sides, end quote, he said in a statement. Al Jazeera has been banned in other countries, including Arab states, who accused the network of biased reporting and support for Islamist political movements, some of them violent, that those countries have suppressed. For many Arabs wary of Islamist groups, Al Jazeera's amplification of Hamas voices is a turnoff, said Mr. Khalil of Cairo University. Ms. Assad of the Palestinian Journalists Syndicate said that imbalances or omissions in coverage should not be grounds for a ban, which critics of the decision said put Israel in the same category as other authoritarian governments that have cracked down on unfriendly news media. Quote, no one has the right to close Israeli television or to silence CNN or to silence anybody, quote, she said. Our next article. At a dinner, Trump assailed climate rules and asked $1 billion from big oil. At a private meeting at Mar-a-Lago, the former president said fossil fuel companies should donate to help him beat President Biden. This article is by Lisa Friedman, Coral Davenport, Jonathan Swan, and Maggie Haberman. Former President Donald J. Trump told a group of oil executives and lobbyists gathered at a dinner at his Mar-a-Lago resort last month that they should donate $1 billion to his presidential campaign because, if elected, he would roll back environmental rules that he said hampered their industry, according to two people who were there. About 20 people attended an April 11th event billed as an, quote, energy roundtable, end quote, at Mr. Trump's private club, according to those people who asked not to be identified in order to discuss the private event. Attendees included executives from ExxonMobil, EQT Corporation, and the American Petroleum Institute, which lobbies for the oil industry. The event was organized by the oil billionaire Harold Hamm, who has for years helped to shape Republican energy policies. It was first reported by the Washington Post. Mr. Trump has publicly railed for months against President Biden's energy and environmental agenda, as Mr. Biden has raced to restore and strengthen dozens of climate and conservation rules that Mr. Trump had weakened or erased while in office. In particular, Mr. Trump has promised to eliminate Mr. Biden's new climate rules intended to accelerate the nation's transition to electric vehicles and to push a drill, baby, drill agenda aimed at opening more public lands to oil and gas exploration. Mr. Biden has called climate change an existential threat and has moved to cut the pollution that is dangerously heating the planet and supercharging storms, heat waves, and drought. Over a dinner of chopped steak, Mr. Trump repeated his public promises to delete Mr. Biden's pollution controls, telling the attendees that they should donate heavily to help him beat Mr. Biden because his policies would help their industries. Quote, "That has been his pitch to everybody," end quote, said Michael McKenna, who worked in the Trump White House but did not attend the event in Florida. Mr. McKenna said the former president's appeal to the fossil fuel industry could be summed up as, "Look, you want me to win. You might not even like me, but your other choice is four more years of these guys," end quote, referring to the Biden administration. He added, quote, "The uniform sentiment of guys in the business community is, we don't want four more years of Team Biden," end quote. Caroline Leavitt, a spokeswoman for the Trump campaign, did not address the specifics of what Mr. Trump was described as saying at the dinner. In a statement, she attacked President Biden as controlled, quote, "by environmental extremists who are trying to implement the most radical energy agenda in the history and force Americans to purchase electric vehicles they can't afford," end quote. And that Mr. Trump is, quote, "supported by people who share his vision of American energy dominance to protect our national security and bring down the cost of living for all Americans," end quote. Mr. Biden's presidential campaign on Thursday accused Mr. Trump of, quote, "straight up selling out working families for campaign donations from oil barons," end quote. Mr. Biden has frustrated the fossil fuel industry by pursuing the most ambitious climate agenda in the nation's history. He has signed a sweeping law that pumps $370 billion into incentives for clean energy and electric vehicles, and has enacted a suite of tough regulations designed to sharply reduce emissions from the burning of oil, gas, and coal. This year, the Biden administration paused the permitting process for new facilities that export liquefied natural gas in order to study their impact on climate change, the economy, and national security. But the fossil fuel industry has also enjoyed record profits under the Biden administration. Last year, the United States produced record amounts of oil, and even with the pause in new permits for gas exports terminals, the United States is the world's leading exporter of natural gas and is still on track to nearly double its export capacity by 2027 because of projects already permitted and under construction. Mr. Biden has also approved several oil and gas projects sought by the fossil fuel industry. He has authorized an enormous $8 billion oil development project in Alaska known as the Willow Project. He also granted a crucial permit for the Mountain Valley Pipeline, a project championed by Senator Joe Manchin III, a West Virginia Democrat, despite opposition from climate experts and environmental groups. Last month, undeterred by opposition from climate activists, the Biden administration also gave approval for an oil export project in Texas known as the Seaport Oil Terminal. Some oil and gas executives have said that they would prefer some of Mr. Biden's regulations to remain, such as a rule requiring companies to detect and stop methane leaks from oil and gas wells. They said they wanted consistency rather than an endless pattern of regulatory whiplash in which rules are enacted by one administration, repealed by the next, and restored by the other after that. Many, however, have attacked Mr. Biden's policies, and the industry has contributed heavily to Mr. Trump's presidential campaign. Although attendees were told that Mr. Trump's event was an energy roundtable, waiting on the chairs of executives and lobbyists at Mar-a-Lago were printouts of PowerPoint slides about migrants at the southern border. Part of the meeting dwelled on migration, and Mr. Trump declared he wanted separate divisions of ultimate fighting championship fighters, one designated for immigrants who came across the border illegal, and the other for, quote, Americans, end quote. The room was filled predominantly with oil and gas executives, including Mike Sable, the chief executive and founder of Venture Global, LNG, Toby Rice, the president and chief executive of EQT Corporation, Jack Fusco, the chief executive of Cheniere Energy, and Nick Del Oso, the president of Chesapeake Energy. Also in the room were Doug Burgum, the governor of North Dakota, and a former Republican presidential candidate who has been acting as Mr. Trump's point man on energy issues, and Mr. Hamm, the billionaire executive chairman of Continental Resources, which is among the biggest oil and gas drilling companies in Oklahoma and North Dakota. Accompanied by Susie Wills, his top political advisor, Taylor Budowich, a former aide, and Meredith O'Rourke, a fundraiser, Mr. Trump asked the executives to detail their concerns on energy issues, according to the two attendees. The American Petroleum Institute, the nation's top fossil fuel industry group, is running an eight-figure national advertising campaign to promote fossil fuels and, quote, dismantle policy threats, end quote, Mike Somers, the chief executive of the trade group, has said. Separately, the American Fuel and Petrochemical Manufacturers, which represents petroleum refiners, has started to buy ads in nine battleground states, urging Americans to fight Mr. Biden's regulation on tailpipe emissions. And states with Republican attorneys general have filed legal challenges against most, if not all, of Mr. Biden's regulations, including a suit announced on Thursday by 27 states arguing that the administration overstepped its authority in cracking down on smokestack pollution from power plants. But Mr. Trump told executives they were not fighting hard enough. He also went on a rant about windmills, the attendees said. Mr. Trump has falsely claimed that wind turbines cause cancer and that offshore wind farms are driving whales crazy. Mr. Trump did not request money in exchange for killing Mr. Biden's climate regulations, the two people in the room maintained. Rather, the former president told executives that he was determined to squash what he considered anti-business policies, and that the oil industry should therefore want him to win and should raise $1 billion to ensure his success. He told the executives that the amount of money they would save in taxes and legal expenses after he repealed regulations would more than cover a $1 billion contribution, the people said. Mr. Ham has had Mr. Trump's ear on energy issues dating back to the former president's 2016 campaign and pushed him to appoint Scott Pruitt to run the Environmental Protection Agency, where Mr. Pruitt denied the established science of climate change and unraveled environmental protections. After Mr. Trump lost the 2020 election, Mr. Ham briefly supported some of the former president's rivals, including Governor Ron DeSantis of Florida and former United Nations Ambassador Nikki Haley. But the oil tycoon appeared to have had a change of heart. Mr. Ham donated $3,300 to Mr. Trump's campaign last year, the maximum allowed for a primary contribution, and another $3,300 in March, according to campaign filings. Mr. Ham did not immediately respond to a request for comment. Mr. McKenna said Mr. Ham continued to play an outsized role in Mr. Trump's energy policy. Quote, "If Harold has an idea, the rest of us have to chase it around," end quote, he said. Quote, "Harold Ham wants that LNG pause gone. He wants the California waiver and the tailpipe rule gone." California has for decades received waivers under the Clean Air Act that authorize it to set environmental rules that are tougher than federal regulations. To do business in California, automakers and other industries must comply with its rules. Mr. Trump has promised to revoke California's waivers. Our last article for today, Stormy Daniels, echoing Trump's style, pushes back at lawyers' attacks. In a second day of cross-examination, Ms. Daniels resisted the implications she had tried to shake down Donald J. Trump by selling her story of a sexual liaison. This story is by Jonah E. Bromwich, Ben Protas, and Maggie Habern. Donald J. Trump, the one-time president, and Stormy Daniels, the longtime porn star, despise one another. But when Ms. Daniels returned to the witness stand at Mr. Trump's criminal trial on Thursday, his lawyers made them sound a lot alike. He wrote more than a dozen self-aggrandizing books. She wrote a tell-all memoir. He mocked her appearance on social media. She fired back with a scatological insult. He peddled a $59.99 Bible. She hawked a $40, quote, "Stormy Saint of Indictments," quote, candle that carried her image draped in a Christ-like robe. During Thursday's grueling cross-examination, Mr. Trump's lawyers sought to discredit Ms. Daniels as a money-grubbing extortionist who used a passing proximity to Mr. Trump to attain fame and riches. But the more the defense assailed her self-promoting merchandise and online screeds, the more Ms. Daniels resembled the man she was testifying against, a master of marketing, a savant of social media scorn. Quote, "Not unlike Mr. Trump," end quote, she said on the stand, though unlike him, she did it without the power and platform of the presidency. Ms. Daniels' appearance plunged the proceedings into turmoil as the defense pleaded with the judge to declare a mistrial in the first criminal trial of an American president. Ms. Daniels' graphic account of a sexual encounter with Mr. Trump, they argued, had inflicted irreparable damage on the defense. But the judge, Juan M. Mershon, rejected the request and rebuked defense lawyers, noting that their decision to deny that the tryst had even occurred had opened the door for much of her explicit testimony. Ms. Daniels offered jurors a first-person account of the encounter with Mr. Trump, helping prosecutors bolster belief in an incident that underpins the case. Her appearance also laid the groundwork for the prosecution's star witness, Michael D. Cohen, who is expected to take the stand Monday, according to people with knowledge of the matter. Mr. Cohen, Mr. Trump's former fixer, bought Ms. Daniels' silence in the final stretch of the 2016 presidential campaign, the payoff that led to the charges against Mr. Trump, who is accused of falsifying records to cover up the scandal. Over nearly 8 hours of searing testimony across 2 days, Ms. Daniels recounted her story of a sexual encounter with Mr. Trump in 2006. She described accepting the $130,000 hush money payment during his first presidential campaign, and facing combative questions from his lawyer about subtle shifts in her story, she swung between defiance and vulnerability. After a shaky performance on the stand earlier in the week, Ms. Daniels on Thursday conceded almost nothing. She had been frazzled. Now she was nimble as she volleyed with her questioner. Suzanne Nichols, a lawyer for Mr. Trump, grilled Ms. Daniels about her account of a one-night stand at a celebrity golf tournament in Nevada. Quote, "You made all of this up, right?" End quote. Ms. Daniels responded with a forceful, quote, "No," end quote. When Ms. Nichols suggested that the porn star had experience with, quote, "phony stories about sex," end quote, Ms. Daniels responded that the sex in her films was, quote, "very much real, just like what happened to me in that room," end quote. And when Ms. Nichols implied that her experience producing films showed that she and how to spin fiction, Ms. Daniels replied, "I would have written it to be a lot better," end quote. Ms. Daniels, wearing a dark green dress and a long black cardigan, showed sensitivity at odds with the defense's gold-digging portrayal when a prosecutor asked her a final question, whether her experience speaking out about Mr. Trump had been positive or negative. She choked up. Quote, "Negative," Daniels said, barely getting the word out, seemingly on the verge of tears. Mr. Trump's lawyers conveyed incredulity, noting that Ms. Daniels had denied the fling at various points. They unearthed inconsistencies, most notably Ms. Daniels' insistence that she had wanted her story out in the world and had little interest in the money. Ms. Nichols, spotlighting Ms. Daniels' effort to sell the story to the media as well as to Mr. Trump, suggested that, in fact, Ms. Daniels had shaken him down. "That's what you were asking in 2016, was for money, to be able to tell your story?" Ms. Nichols asked pointedly, adding, "That was your choice, right?" Ms. Daniels resisted, saying she accepted an offer from Mr. Cohen in the waning days of the 2016 campaign because she was, quote, "running out of time," end quote. But Ms. Nichols noted that she could have told her story for free. She pointed to evidence that Ms. Daniels had flirted with doing so, but had abandoned discussions with a reporter from Slate magazine. Quote, "You could have gone out any day of the week," end quote, and given a news conference, Ms. Nichols said, quote, "But you chose not to, right?" End quote. That concludes the New York Times NewsHour for Friday, the 10th of May, 2024, from Radio Reading Services of the Cincinnati Association for the Blind and Visually Impaired. My name is John Zinser. Thank you for the pleasure of your company and the honor of your time.